by the end of 1973, beginning of 74, David Bowie had reached another new phase in his career. He decided to disband the Spiders, who'd been with him for two very successful years, and to begin to employ musicians on a less permanent basis, a situation that exists to this day.
The nicest thing about that particular kind of working is that they don't feel they're my band. I mean, they work with me, and that's as far as it goes, which is the nicest thing. And when we finish a tour, they go off immediately and do other things and work with other people and work with other bands. They don't look to me to supply them with ideas and whatever. They come in and they work and work well and want to work with me, but they'd hate to feel they were tied to me. Maybe if the Spiders had worked with me in that capacity, I think we may well have been together still. But they felt too tight. They were really looking to me to supply them with new identities. And I said, but no, there isn't a band in the next concept. The next concept is, you know, it comes to Lad Insane on his own. And then having done that, I want to write about the cities that Ziggy comes from, like the Diamond Dogs thing, and there isn't a band in that.
Yeah.
title song from what was Bowie's big new concept. And in truth, it's hard to see how the Spiders could have fitted into it.
It might have stagnated. It would have stagnated, I know, because Mick and I weren't seeing eye to eye towards the end. I wanted to get more illegitimate, and he wanted to get more legitimate rock and roll, which, of course, is exactly what he has done. He's now working with Dylan, or whatever. You couldn't get more reactionary than that. Michael, get away from there. What are you doing? I wanted not to become that establishment. I still wanted to be able to be treated more as a clown, or thought of as somebody who plays with rock and roll and doesn't take it seriously.
No sooner did Bowie drop those three old friends than he picked up another one right out of the blue, Tony Visconti.
He started producing a group which we never heard of and never will hear of, fantastic idea called the Astronettes, which consisted of his lifelong buddy, Jeffrey McCormick, who is now called Warren Peace. He's changed his name to Warren Peace, who's still with David, and Ava Cherry, and this other guy, the tall black American guy. The three of them formed this group called the Astronettes, and David was producing them. And the first time we actually did work together again, he asked me to write some strings and arrangements for them, and also for one of his own tracks, for his forthcoming album, and the track was called 1984. And he said, could you write some sort of Barry White strings for that, you know? I said, okay. So we got together again, and it worked beautifully. And that's when he said, wow, we still have it. He says, you know, Tony, I really enjoyed those two albums, were the best times of my life, and let's get back together again and work again when this album's finished. And I said, okay, you know. So I didn't intend to work on Diamond Dogs because it was nearly finished. Then I received a phone call from him a few weeks later, and he said, look, I'm having trouble mixing this album. I can't seem to get a good mix anywhere in town. So he came to my newly built studio in Shepherd's Bush, and he was the very first thing I ever did in my new studio was mix Diamond Dogs with David.
Diamond Dogs was Bowie's most dramatic concept to date. So what was it all about?
It was predicting the end of this civilization. Clearly, to me, that's what it is. Diamond Dogs is the last rock and roll group. I think he has visions, maybe I'm giving too much away, but he's going to make the film. I think in one version of the song, the dogs actually eat people, or they kill people on stage, or they shoot machine guns back at the audience, things like that. He has these horrible visions of the apocalypse, you know, the end of the civilization as we know it. And most of those songs were all about that, the Big Brother song at the end. If you'd have seen the Diamond Dogs show in the States, the very eerie set that he had designed to sing these songs in, oh, it was a beautiful, beautiful set, but it was like some sort of atomic bomb blasted city. Some of the skyscrapers were like molten steel, and there was one little bridge left where Bowie sang on top of this bridge with a, this set's been described before, but Bowie was trying to get very close to this image of a crumbling civilization, and he's going to make a film. Well, he's written a script for Diamond Dogs properly as a film, and I hope he brings it off. He's very much obsessed with the end of the civilization. That's what Diamond Dogs is all about.
Yeah, the sky is blue. Life is beautiful. I'm looking for the treason that I knew in 65. Where the past is yours. Oh, 1984.
Diamond Dogs owes something to all the stories of cataclysm that Bowie had read, and that, of course, includes Orwell's 1984, the title of that particular track. It's perhaps interesting at this point in the last program to look a little closer at how the creative juices of Bowie's flow.
I spend most of the time just thinking about the concept and shape and size and texture of the thing rather than the actual writing of it. But I think this is an important part of creative work as a actually doing anything like putting it down on paper or on a tape or whatnot. I think thinking, I spend a lot of time thinking. That tires me out. And then I have a sleep. Then I go and get drunk and I go and do things that I can think about the next day. And somewhere along the line they get transferred into actual physical matter, like an album or a photograph or a painting or something.
The actual studio time involved can in fact be very short.
I can knock an album out in a week, complete, mixed and everything. But as soon as I go in, I know exactly what I'm doing. There's no experimentation when I go in the studio. There hasn't been anyway up until now, but the next album I think I'm going to open myself up to sort of some leeway of experimentation. And we'll see what happens. I don't know what'll happen. I've never worked like that before. I'm always being very tight and sort of very calculating about that. But that's because I was a draftsman and a commercial artist, I guess, so it comes out of a concept. The concept's born up there, and you think about that a lot, and you just slam into it, and you know exactly what it's going to look like before you start. And that's how the albums get made. The guys I'm working with often have trouble keeping up with me because I work very quickly, and they're often dissatisfied with their own takes and things. And I say, no, that's the one I want, and move straight on, moving right along now. As long as it has some sort of integral quality of disharmony about it, it stays on.
Yeah.
There were touches of self-portraiture to Rebel. Come to think of it, though, David had tamed another Rebel for a short time, had written and produced a hit for Lou Reed, Walk on the Wild Side.
We tried to produce Lou, you see, which was a bad mistake, but it, I suppose commercially it did well for him, and I guess because of that, he probably holds it against me. But Lou's like that. Oh, he is. I see he's stubborn. Yeah, we tried to do a number on Lou, because I wanted to have a lot of my attitude toward Lou Reed on the album. Lou, of course, had just revolted right and went straight back to what he used to be for a bit. And that Lulu thing, I mean, that was, you know, that was sort of very, I mean, I was amazed. To give her a sort of a song about finding angels and devils in yourself, I mean, it was a sort of a naughty thing to do, but it was... It seemed nice at the time, but again, it was hard for Lulu to sort of do anything after that with the particular thing that I gave her. And she started dressing up in these funny suits and looking like a boy and everything. And I thought, you know, again, she was trying to get lost in my identity of her. So I thought, when I'd done Lulu, I thought I'd better stop doing this. Because I felt somewhat like a Svengali, and it's very easy for me to do that, fall into that role. It's the director's job. I mean, I was, again, sort of, you know, giving vent to my cinematic pretensions and creating little pastiche sort of filmlet things for people and casting them in roles and sort of directing the whole thing and then forgetting to tell them it was a film, you know, and so they were sort of looking for their next set of, they wanted the next day's shooting, you know, and I didn't have any more scripts.
Perhaps one day we may see Bowie in the role of film director, something we might look at later in the programme. Anyway, back to Diamond Dogs and the 1974 American tour that resulted from it.
I started thinking about how hard it is for musicians to take a part in rock theatre. And that's when I tried to lose musicians on the Diamond Dog show. And that failed dismally, because everybody complained. I said, we don't like playing behind these bleeding screens. I said, but you got to, because I haven't got any parts for you. They said, but we're, you know, I said, but I don't want people to see you playing, because it doesn't look like a street if there's a bass amp stuck in the middle. But it was very hard to sort of convince them about that. So they all left me. And the show sort of, you know, gradually fell apart, which it should have done, because it was about a decaying city. So it was quite apropos that it should fall down in the middle of the tour. But everything really did start falling apart. It really did become a Diamond Dog sort of city.
It was on that tour in the Tower Theatre, Philadelphia, that the David Bowie Live album was made, an album for which a lot of the credit must go to Tony Visconti.
What made it very difficult was the Diamond Dog set, because to necessitate recording it live, David had to have 8 microphones all around the set, because he'd be singing Ground Control to Major Tom on top of this cherry picker seat. He'd be about 6 rows out over the audience, and he'd be singing into a telephone handpiece. That was the microphone that recorded his vocal on that. And on the album, I could say that we didn't do any cheating. Those are all his live vocals. The only thing that was overdubbed was the backing vocals, because they were dancing most of the time. The backing vocalists were jumping all about the stage. We couldn't record them successfully at all. can't really produce the live report. It just happens, and you set up your mics and get it. But I mixed it as best I could. He was pleased with that. But still, I wasn't doing the job I would have liked to have done with David. But as a result of doing the live album, he said, listen, I've got this great idea. He says, America, he said, I'll make a prophecy that America is going to go really black very soon. He said, black music is taking over. I want to make a black album. I want to make a soul album. And there's this place in Philadelphia called Sigma Sound, and that's the place to do it. And I'm going to get Willie Weeks on bass. And when he mentioned Willie Weeks, that opened my eyes. Willie Weeks is one of my favorite bass players. So I said, I'll do it. That's how Young Americans came about.
In the middle of the Diamond Dogs tour, there was a break of about 4 weeks, and that's when work on the Young Americans album began. But wait a minute, Tony Visconti was back with David again. Where was Bowie getting some of his oddball inspirations from? Surely his private life wasn't lacking in excitement.
Without going into detail, his personal life is quite exciting, and one could fill volumes with the way he carries on. I don't have to go into detail. I think it's generally known that, he's an experiment. I mean, he encourages friendships with the strangest people that I would consider, well, any most people consider strange. I mean, I thought I was broad-minded until I met David Bowie. But bless him, that's where a lot of his inspiration comes from. And I mean, you can't get a steady diet of unusual people all the time, and I suppose when he's not meeting unusual people or encouraging such friendships, he's just sort of fantasizing about it, and he makes up a few of his own unusual people.
So, to return to the Young Americans album, the one that a lot of people called his soul album.
Yeah, that's when I became B.B. King, and the sort of R&B thing, because I was left sort of to meddle around a bit, not having a concept to work on, so I thought, well, I'll be the radio. So I recorded the radio for a few weeks and listened to some sort of soul things, and did the Young Americans album, which was the radio, really. The Young Americans was American radio.
All the way from Washington, a breath when a breath up about food.
Ago anybody had said that that was an R&B album, but it would have been a laughing stock thing, because it's not, it has nothing to do with R&B. It's perfect, just sort of synthetic radio stuff. The stuff of radio.
Whatever it is, that track in particular is amongst Bowie's best work, and as a single, gave him greater success than ever before in the United States. It was the first track recorded for the new album, and featured a whole lot of new musicians. The rhythm section centering around Carlos Alomar.
These people hadn't played together before, I hadn't worked with them, and it was the very first track we did was Young Americans, which it happened, you know, and these backing vocals came up the next day, which was the beginning of using Luther Vandross, who sang on Young Americans, and two other people. Carlos's wife, Robin, sang, and Ava Cherry, and we didn't know if that would work out, but it all worked out. Within 2 days, we had recorded Young Americans, the single, just that one title, and I think that was my favorite track. There are one or two others that no one has heard yet, because David later finished Young Americans without me and recorded Fame and Across the Universe, and he took off one of my favorite tracks, which is called It's Gonna Be Me, but no one's heard it except me and a few other people. He took it off to make room for Fame and all that.
What began smoothly turned out to be something of a nightmare for Tony Visconti. At first, Bowie planned what was to be really a soul album, then decided that he wanted it to be a Bowie album after all. On re-recording, Fascination was added, and Can You Hear Me? Also a Bruce Springsteen song, but that was later ditched.
Now we're talking about November and October. November, we're still working on Young Americans. We're re-recording a few tracks, we're recording Fascination. Instead of mixing it in London, David said he wanted to be present for the mixes. And around that time, the tour had just finished, and he was sort of really letting go. He had been fairly disciplined for that tour, as disciplined as he can get. And he really is quite a wild person. He doesn't like being that well-disciplined. And he sort of went to pieces towards the end of Young Americans. And a lot of the times when I was mixing, he wanted me in New York to mix, but he just simply didn't make it to the studio because he was just unloading his mind of all these other things he wanted to do, like write his film, for instance, playing with his video recorders. And then Mick Jagger was in town, and he was taking up quite a lot of David's time. And David was sort of going out, partying, working on his films, staying up for days. And here I was, stuck in the studio, finishing off Young Americans, doing the mixing and doing some more overdubs. And that was it. I finished it, and we had about 14 sessions booked to finish Young Americans. David made it to about three of them. So under those conditions, I had to finish the album the second time. Almost the same way I finished The Man Who Stole the World, it was done that way. Only that time, David was involved with Angela. It was a different... Something was keeping him away from the studio then.
Someone else was to put in an appearance. Make his mark, too. John Lennon.
The night before I left for London, David said, "Oh, I want you to come up to my room tonight. So John Lennon's coming. So I want you to meet him." And he said, "It's the first time I'm meeting him too, and I'm ever so excited. And you'll like him, Tony." And I said, "Great." So I went to the hotel room, and we met John Lennon together and stayed up all night singing rock and roll songs and talking about David's film and all that. And I went back to London the next day. And a week later, David phoned me up and he said, "Tony, I hope you don't mind, but I went in the studios with John yesterday." That was the beginning of a beautiful relationship between. "I went in the studios with John last night and I recorded Across the Universe." I said, "Oh, great, I don't mind." But what David didn't tell me was that it was to go on Young Americans, which I found out several weeks later due to press releases. David never told me that they were going to replace two tracks on Young Americans. So I sort of read it in the papers that that's what happened. And I was a bit hurt by that because I had worked from August to January on Young Americans and it didn't even come out in the version that I finished it in. So for the second time, folks, it was the end of a beautiful friendship between me and David.
A last minute thing with John came down to the studios and we'd been using a riff for another song and I said I got Carlo to play the riff and John and I just started mucking around with the tune. It was just a jam really, and that's when I thought maybe I should start experimenting in studio a bit more, which is what I will do next time.
Fame was an American number one, his greatest single success. The album was a major seller as well. Even at the peak, there were more changes to come. David and his longtime manager, Tony DeFries, parted company. Now, Bowie manages himself.
I'm much more laid back about business and how much people should pay me for doing a job, and that's all it is, that's all management is. You look at yourself and decide how much you're worth, and so I've got used to putting a price on myself, which is a kind of a really odd thing to have to do, but it's quite fun, actually.
Bowie's first major screen part was to come. Filmed in New Mexico last summer, Nicholas Roeg's film, The Man Who Fell to Earth, features Bowie as a visitor from another planet. For those who know him well, there's a lot of Bowie in Thomas Newton. Even so, the part was a complete change for him.
The film is the first thing that I've been given where I didn't have to play a rock and roll star for star. I wasn't required to sing. The only thing they'd asked me to do was write some music, which I got out of doing, because I didn't want my music to be attached to the film either. I didn't want it to sell on a soundtrack. I wanted it to be considered as a serious sort of attempt at acting, or non-acting, as the character. It has no idea of expression or anything. No humour whatsoever. So I had to play very, very straight. And some days my face ached through not being able to use it. Everything had to be absolutely expressionless. And I wasn't to put ennui or innuendo in any of the statements that I made. It was very much like that. It was painful to do that way. 3 months of being totally the Iceman cometh. I mean, it was absolutely that. But I realised that when I'd done the film and seen some of the rushes on video, how effective it is putting that non-acting role into surrounded by people who were totally caught up in their own emotions, like Candy Clark is an overabundance of emotion. And to put someone with that little emotion in them produces a very poignant situation.
The film, released in Britain in March, has already received much critical acclaim. There's little doubt that Bowie will continue to work in films. But how did his, by now notoriously butterfly nature, put up with the discipline of filming?
The flitting that I do only comes in the creation of something. Once I settle down to do it, I take the concept through to its logical conclusion and right behind it. I don't fall out of love with things in the middle of them. If I'm serious about them, I'll do them. But once I have done them, I don't want to look at it anymore, have anything to do with it, because I usually drain myself off into that particular thing.
Filming for The Man Who Fell to Earth was completed in late autumn of last year. What then?
And then I thought, I better settle down and do some work now. So I thought, I'm going back to Europe, so I'll write a European album from Station to Station, which is my sort of salute to the East from the West, you know, America. It's really European. It really is, isn't it? I'll have to listen to it again. No, of course it's not all of it, but there's lots of it that owe a lot to the French and German rock scene. Things like Words on a Wing and the opening track, Station to Station, is quite German. And Words on a Wing is very sort of a Germanic romantic statement. It's back to me German romance again. And TVC15, I guess that's a bit of a hodgepodge. Sort of influenced by the film. All the television sets and everything.
She's alright in my life. She's alright in my life.
Inspired by the film and Bowie's current single, TVC 15. There's a growing feeling among his friends and associates that perhaps David is beginning to lose his interest in music and is now recording and touring simply in order to finance his interest in films. He owns up to that last film being very much a means to an end.
I want to work with directors that I admire just to see how they do it and why they got where they are artistically, how they arrived at their conclusions and steal a little bit from each of them in technique and how to handle crews and things like that. And that's the problem that one doesn't think about before you go and do a film, is how you handle a great 50, 60 film crew. Film crews are very different to rock and roll, road crews. So I sort of sit back and be very Capricorn and just sort of watch everything and learn how to do it, and then I'll go and do it better.
One of the new age of Bowie musicians is Carlos Alomar. Guitarist and former leader of the Main Ingredients band, he'd worked on Young Americans and now was called up for work on Station to Station.
There was a year between each album, I suppose. Then I got this phone call. Can you be down here in 2 days?
What?
2 days. No, I think they gave me a little bit more time than that. 4 days.
Well, Carlos was right there, but the rest of the rhythm lineup had been changed.
Now it was me, Dennis Davis, and a new bass player, George Murray. It was really good, too. Then we came in there, and David had a few things that he wanted us to hear, which is the way he does it, you know. He lets us listen to a few things he was working with. And then he breaks it down to us in parts, and then we just figure out artistically what we could contribute to those changes, you know. And then it just becomes a point of who he picks again. And that really went well. At times it was very strange because this album is a little bit different. Well, it's a little bit more rock and roll, more R&R than R&B, as opposed to Young Americans, which was more R&B than R&R. So the overtone was much more rock and roll. So when it came across, you know, it came out that way. Although certain parts, when we were playing them, we didn't quite understand what David was trying to make. For instance, Station to Station. Now we're playing a heavy, heavy, you know, dan, dan, nice hard rock and roll line. And then David says, okay, you guys, I want you to play arpeggios. Arpeggios. David, are you sure? He says, yeah, I can hear it. And I say, arpeggios, okay. I say, okay, fellas, we're going to play arpeggios here. You know, after part B, arpeggios are coming. So we did them in harmony, which is to suit our taste, and yet we did arpeggios to suit his. And they came out and they worked out pretty well. Because on Station to Station, the return of the Thin White Duke is done under the arpeggio.
The Thin White Duke is the guise under which Bowie has been appearing on his most recent North American and European tours. Thomas Newton hits Max Reinhardt, as Bowie would probably say. One of the band's favorite tracks on tour and on Station to Station is this one, Stay.
It meant a lot to us because at that tune, unlike others which we would, you know, doing at 4 o'clock in the morning, that one was done at a good time, the best conditions, the best day of the whole recording. Everybody's feeling good and everybody's contributing the most. That's why it's got so much energy. That meant a lot to us, you know. And then when we went back into the studio and he says, okay, we're doing John Amore Dancing, but we're doing it different. So we started thinking about what type of, what it is that he really wants, you know. And then we came across with, you know, the ideas to stay in the different parts. The chorus was allowed to stay somewhat of the same, because I liked what I was playing on the chorus, and I begged him to let me play it again, and he says, well, okay, play that. And I said, cool. Otherwise, it wouldn't be the same tune at all. I just particularly like that tune because of all the energy that's going on. And then when everything was added to it, all the overdubs and just everything, it was just really dynamic tune. My favorite.
Bowie is, as you might imagine, quite critical of his own work, dismissing the greater part of it in a few words. What then was really worthwhile?
The ones that I actually think are quite worthy of something were Diamond Dogs and Ziggy Stardust. Ziggy Stardust, I think, is probably my definitive album, as I've been told. And Diamond Dogs, though, I think is a very important album. I thought that was the nearest that I've done to a cinematic experience for me. For me, personally, it was my sort of Fritz Lang statement. It was my Metropolis in sort of a sound form. I think Station to Station is interesting. It's not important, but it's interesting because it seems to indicate some return to an earlier style of recording and writing for me. So I'm quite excited about the next one. I can't wait to see what it's going to be like. I expect it'll be quite interesting. I don't know if it'll be important, though. You know, I think time tells that. I can't help think. It's always like painting to me, all of this. Even a stage performance, it's the same. But recording especially, recording for me is just like doing a painting. You start off with a blank bit of canvas and you start work on it, and sometimes it comes off and sometimes it doesn't. There's no difference between that and painting. There really isn't.
At the point at which your average rock star a definition, incidentally, that he's always disclaimed, has either gone or is on his way out, David Bowie seems almost to be just on the threshold of his career. Had he any understanding of or reason for this phenomenon?
I'm very quick to, for me, to own up to Ziggy Stardust was my statement. But I've always thought that in rock, that you can only say one thing in rock and roll, really, and everything else is just an expansion of that original statement. It certainly seems like that with the stuff that I've done. And some of it does qualify the original statement, and it's the whole period. This was my rock and roll period. Rather than dividing the rock period up into bits, it's just looking at the whole rock period. So that was my rock period, and it dealt with this particular attitude. Rock and roll is the decision of being establishment or non-establishment. That's the problem that rock and roll sort of poses. To be or not to be a rebel, you know, is what it's really what it says and always has said.
If Bowie's rock and roll period has now been and gone, have we then seen the real David Bowie?
I'm sure David hasn't seen the real David Bowie yet. He's a remarkable person. He's a whatever you call him. He assimilates everything he sees, and he becomes it. He is the world. He's everyone else, but he's not himself. It's not such a bad thing to be, really. You know, a lot of people like to think they're somebody, but they really aren't. And David admits that he isn't any one person. He's just everything. He's got the innocence of a child, really. He's always looking at things. He's always interested. A lot of other pop stars that I know just sort of stay in their limousines and go from hotel room to hotel room. David more or less has to do that now because he'd be mobbed if he walked around. But, for instance, when he did his Japanese tour, he insisted on coming back on the Trans-Siberian Express from Japan, and he would get off at stops and talk to Russian people. And it must have been a terrific encounter. Redhead David, Ziggy Stardust, talking to a Russian peasant. But he did, and he stopped in East Germany, and he stayed with the Japanese people. He's ever so, oh, what's the word? He's open. His attention is expansive, you know. He's always looking at everything and doing everything, you know. He's assimilating everything and becoming those objects.
Shadows in this golden year. How's it going, baby boy? theme is, I think, is incredible. I think he's got the magic that makes an artist. That's the only way you can describe him. There's so much talent in every area. Just great.
His greatest asset is his intuition. He's always far ahead of everybody. Things that he was doing in 1968, people did in 1970. And I think that's happened today. He was so right about the glam bit. He is the first social phenomenon to arrive since the Beatles on the level of pop music. That the Beatles were something more than just music. They changed the whole image of the Englishman. They made a big social statement. And I think that David has done that.
I think really it's still very hard for anybody to actually pin down David Bowie, which is lovely. I think that's very cute. And is exactly what I wanted.
These David Bowie programs were written, presented and produced by Stuart Grundy. Next week in this spot, Paul Gambaccini begins a new series of programs about another unique British artist, Elton John.